led organizations and the media that they show and the resources that they share, it does not use force. No, it doesn't use like that. And it on the mainstream, it almost seems like the whole messaging of, you know, that started these protests are kind of getting drowned out by, I don't know, by just not talking about it or just not, mm-hmm. you know, like not having that be the front thing. It's just, you know, and meanwhile, like, you know, don't shoot PDX. It's, you know, I can't imagine like having all of this like stuff behind you and then like just kind of, you know, I just hope that like, you know, things don't repeat themselves and we do all of this and all of this destruction and all of this discomfort and like something I hope, you know, comes out of it that is going to be worth it, that we're going to look back and say, yep, it was worth it. It was hard. It was super hard, but look at us now. We're a better society for all that discomfort and, you know, growing pain. Mm-hmm. Oh my, yeah. I just realized it's almost 9:00. Shh. It's time to wrap it up.
Yeah, we gotta get going.
Althea, I appreciate you, like always. Sonia, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Sonia.
I guess we'll talk next week.
See you next time. Girls, who run the world? Girls, who run the world?
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Salem Progressive Film Series presentation of The Long and Twisted Tale of Jordan Cove LNG. This slideshow depicts part two of Barbara Bernstein's radio documentary series, Holding the Thin Green Line, which explores what is at stake in Southern Oregon if the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and Pacific Connected Gas Pipeline get built. From July 27th to the 31st, this slideshow video can be viewed at your own convenience at holdingthethingreenline.org/Jordan Cove Slideshow. Then on July 31st from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m., we'll hold a live Q&A session with impacted landowners, community organizers, and land and water protectors who are featured in the documentary. Again, that's The Long and Twisted Tale of Jordan Cove LNG documentary slideshow screening, July 27th to the 31st, and a live on Zoom Q&A on July 31st. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Sojourner Truth, thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Even as civil rights veterans and the nation mourn the passing of two civil rights icons, C.T. Vivian and John Lewis, yet another civil rights leader, Charles Evers, has died. He was the brother of Medgar Evers, who was assassinated outside his home in front of his family. C.T. Vivian's funeral takes place today, Thursday, July 23rd, in Atlanta, Georgia. Today, for our ongoing Campaigners for Black Life series, we speak with Dr. Roslyn Satchel, giving reaction from the perspective of Black Lives activists of the contributions of the civil rights icons. What has the Black Lives Matter movement of today gleaned from their predecessors? For our weekly Earth Watch, we speak with Aaron Langell, photojournalist and strategic communications director for the Global Justice Ecology Project. We discuss how the struggle in Portland relates to the Pinochet era in Chile and also attacks on the Mapuche, who are indigenous to Chile. And protests continue in Portland, Oregon, despite the presence of what many now refer to as Donald Trump's private army. We speak with Portland-based activist Mike Crenshaw and for legal analysis, attorney Marjorie Cohn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headline.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. President Trump announced he will send federal agents to Chicago and Albuquerque, New Mexico, to help combat rising crime. The announcement represents an expansion of the administration's intervention into law enforcement as he runs for re-election under a law and order mantle. Trump has been painting Democratic-led cities as lawless and out of control.
New York and Chicago and Philadelphia and Detroit and Baltimore and all of these, Oakland is a mess. We're not going to let this happen in our country. All run by liberal Democrats.
Critics say Trump is overstepping his authority, and mayors of cities on his target list say they'll fight him in court. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio told CNN Trump is abusing his authority.
What is he using them for? He's using them for crowd control, for repressing the right of people to protest, for a political stunt, obviously, for his own reelection.
The plan Trump announced Wednesday expands an existing program that sent hundreds of federal agents to Kansas City after a four-year-old boy's shooting death to help quell a record rise in violence. Federal troops and unmarked vehicles sent to Portland, Oregon recently snatched protesters off the street without probable cause. The Oregon Attorney General is suing the federal government over the practice. Senate Republicans and the White House reached tentative agreement for more testing funds in the next COVID-19 relief package, but deep disagreements remain over the scope of the $1 trillion in federal aid remaining ahead of today's expected rollout. Facing a GOP revolt, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was preparing a handful of separate COVID-19 aid bills. That's according to a top lawmaker involved in the negotiations. A key holdup reportedly remains President Trump's push for a payroll tax cut. Hardly any GOP senators support the idea. Instead, McConnell and some Republicans prefer another round of direct $1,200 cash payments to Americans. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said the negotiators have agreed to an amount on direct payments, but declined to share details. The House has approved a bill to remove statues of General Robert E. Lee and other Confederate leaders from the U.S. Capitol as a reckoning over racial injustice continues in the nation. The House vote also would remove a bust of Chief Justice Roger B. Taney, the author of the 1857 Dred Scott decision that declared African Americans couldn't be U.S. citizens. The bill directs the architect of the Capitol to identify and eventually remove from Statuary Hall at least 10 statues honoring Confederate officials, including Lee, the commanding general of the Confederate Army, and Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president. Three statues honoring white supremacists, including former U.S. Vice President John C. Calhoun of South Carolina, would be immediately removed. The House approved the bill 305-113, sending it to the Republican-controlled Senate. China is condemning the U.S. government's order to close its Houston consulate. Beijing maintains that charges of Chinese agents trying to steal data from Texas facilities are bogus. Beijing says it may retaliate in kind. Feature Story News' Patrick Falk reports from Beijing.
The reasons behind the move by Washington remain unclear, but on Thursday, Chinese media lined up to accuse the U.S. of playing politics. The state-run Global Times said the November presidential election is driving Washington mad. The official English-language China Daily called it an attempt to paint China as a malevolent actor on the world stage. The U.S. confirmed on Wednesday it's given China just 72 hours to shut the consulate in Houston. It comes as Washington's put a spotlight on what it's called Chinese espionage activities. Acting chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Marco Rubio, described the consulate in Houston as the central node of the Communist Party's vast network of spies and influence operations in the United States. Patrick Falk, Beijing.
California has surpassed New York for the most confirmed coronavirus cases in the nation. Christina Onestad reports.
In California, nearly 8,000 have died from the coronavirus. Governor Newsom says Californians should continue to wear masks to slow spread of the virus.
I cannot encourage people more.
To that end, he says the state has distributed 86.4 million N95 masks and 297 million surgical masks. And he says he secured 120 million more N95 masks and 300 million more surgical masks for frontline workers. Meanwhile, as coronavirus infections continue to soar in California, the governor's emergency orders, including a moratorium on evictions for those who cannot pay their rent due to the coronavirus pandemic, are set to expire soon. Newsom says he'll be making an announcement Friday about that. I'm Christina Onnested, reporting for KPFA.
And I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
On Friday, July 17th, the world lost 2 hours of the civil rights movement in the United States. C.T. Vivian and Congressman John Lewis. C.T. Vivian was an activist, author, minister, and lead organizer during the civil rights movement alongside the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In 1947, C.T. Vivian took part in his first sit-in demonstrations, which successfully integrated Barton's Cafeteria in Illinois. He co-founded the Nashville Christian Leadership Conference and helped coordinate sit-in protests against segregation in Nashville in 1960 and an historic civil rights march the following year. He also participated in the Freedom Rides, in which activists traveled on interstate buses across segregated states in the South. Congressman John Lewis served as the chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, known as SNCC, from 1963 to 1966. In 1965, on a day known as Bloody Sunday, he was beat up with batons by police on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, resulting in a fractured skull. Funeral services for C.T. Vivian are set for Thursday, July 23rd in Atlanta, Georgia, but the funeral services for Congressman John Lewis have not been fully announced. Now, Alden D. Morris described Vivian as one of his favorite civil rights warriors and Lewis as someone who personified the youth wing of the civil rights movement. And we're going to be discussing with a voice from the Black Lives Matter movement their thoughts on the legacy of these civil rights icons on the Black Lives Matter movement today. But let us go to a clip now from a speech that John Lewis gave in Washington, D.C. It is from the OWN network.
We start organizing. We were able to bring more than 250,000 people to march in Washington. And we all had to prepare a speech. I was very young, 23 years old, had all of my hair and a few pounds lighter.
I have the pleasure to present to this.
When A. Philip Randolph said, I now present to you young John Lewis, the national chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Brother John Lewis.
I looked to my right. I saw hundreds and hundreds of young people who had been involved during the early days. Looked straight ahead. I saw this sea of humanity. Then I looked to the left. I saw young black men and young white men up in the trees, trying to get a better view. And then I said to myself, well, this is it. And I looked straight ahead again. And something said to me, go for it. And I opened my mouth and I started speaking.
We march today for jobs and freedom. But we have nothing to be proud of. For hundreds and thousands of our brothers are not here, for they're receiving starvation wages or no wages at all. Those who have said be patient and wait, we must say that we cannot be patient. We do not want our freedom gradually, but we want to be free now. The time will come when we will not confine our marching to Washington. We will march through the South, through the streets of Jackson, through the streets of Danville, through the streets of Cambridge, through the streets of Birmingham. We must say, wake up, America, wake up, for we cannot stop, and we will not and cannot be patient.
I would now like to welcome our guest, Dr. Roslyn Satchel, an organizer with Black Lives Matter Los Angeles. Dr. Satchel is also a critical race studies activist scholar who researches and teaches about communication, ethics, and law. She serves as the Blanche E. Seaver Professor of Communication at Pepperdine University. She's an experienced strategic communication consultant and an elder in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. In her book, What Movies Teach You About Race, Exceptionalism, Erasure, and Entitlement, she brings her media, legal, and religion background together to examine cultural representations in the most influential films of all time. So, Dr. Roslyn Satchel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Margaret, for having us.
Yeah, and we do partner with Black Lives Matter LA for our ongoing weekly series, Campaigners for Black Lives. So what I wanted to raise with you, an author who has studied the work of these civil rights icons, both C.T. Vivian as well as John Lewis, said that Martin Luther King personified the adult wing of the civil rights movement and John Lewis personified the youth wing of the civil rights movement. Now, the clip, the speech I just played in Washington, D.C., was very controversial, SNCC being the young militants. John Lewis was very young at the time, and indeed there was controversy over the speech, and they had to negotiate with the civil rights leaders, including the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, over the words in the speech, and eventually John Lewis did agree, and the SNCC leaders did agree to somewhat temper the speech, but it was still considered very, very militant at the time. I wondered to get your response about that speech in and of itself, and then we can discuss a bit more how, you know, activists in the Black Lives Matter movement, what they are gleaning from these civil rights icons.
Absolutely. We are most excited, quite honestly, in looking back at Congressman John Lewis's life and Reverend C.T. Vivian's life, because we have personal connections with them. So to remember them and to talk about their impact on us as organizers within the Black Lives Matter Network is really an honor, a high honor for us. I remember when Congressman John Lewis, he came and visited us here in Los Angeles as well as in Nashville to spend time with many of our Black Lives Matter organizers. As a part of our political education, part of what we do is try to make sure that our organizers have an opportunity to learn with and learn from some of our elders and ancestors who've been doing this work for decades. We even pull out some who've done it for centuries. We go back to the archives and bring up as much material as we can because we recognize that we're a part of that same movement. We see ourselves a part of a larger historical continuum. We see it through the long view of history, the long view of the movement, so that when we learn about the strategies of nonviolence that John Lewis and C.T. Vivian utilized, we can also deconstruct those strategies and see what worked and what did not work. What did work was pulling in, of course, media attention in order to sway public opinion, in order so that regular citizens of our country would be able to see what was happening to them in the South. We've used those same strategies in Black Lives Matter to help people, regular, average, ordinary people, discover their voices, in critiquing these very desperate times that we're in. When Congressman Lewis visited with us, he encouraged our work. He always supported our work. He actually pushed back against this narrative of respectability in the civil rights movement that we often hear. He helped us to understand that public opinion was not on their side when they started. They were called interlopers. They were grouped together with carpetbaggers. They were called disruptors. Many of them were called many more vicious pejoratives that we well know of. Lewis and Vivian fought, and they disrupted everything that they could. Had they not stopped traffic or disrupted commerce, disrupted the bus schedules, bus lines, had they not disrupted business as usual, they could not have disrupted white supremacy. But they did, and that is what we continue doing. When we've gotten critiques about our BLM freeway shutdowns and shutting down traffic and shutting down centers of commerce, it was really exciting to hear John Lewis actually liken his work to ours and to tell us that that's the same thing that they were doing on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Literally, when asked a question, what do you think of these critiques of our BLM freeway shutdowns, he said, what do you think happened on the march on the Edmund Pettus Bridge? They disrupted the status quo, and we continue to do that.
Yeah, and you know, the movement of really led by young people, certainly with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, just on Tuesday, where we did our tribute to C.T. Vivian and John Lewis. Betty Mae Fikes was with us and was on the show. She was known as the voice of Selma, but she joined the movement. I think Betty Mae must have been like 13 or 14 and ignored her parents' mm-hmm. advice and was supposed to be going on an errand, and instead she went to a church where a rally was being held. So, and today we see very much youth on the street. But I wanted you to comment on this finally. Just shortly after the death of these two civil rights icons in Montgomery, Alabama, you had five elders who were part of the Save Ourselves Movement for Justice and Democracy in Montgomery, Alabama. They were arrested. They basically were doing a peaceful protest. They were arrested. They were strip searched. They were dehumanized. And they were charged, actually. And it was just iconic. I mean, we spoke with John Zippard, who is a black farmer, who came out of that movement and knew both John Lewis and C.T. Vivian, about that outrage happening so many decades after so many people gave their lives for our rights, and people like John Lewis and C.T. Vivian being arrested so many times and beat so many times. I wanted you to quickly comment on that. But also, I have long worried, having come through the movement myself, the civil rights era and the mm-hmm. Black Power era, the movements in which I was trained, worried about the crackdown that was bound to happen with the Black Lives Movement happening on the street. And now we see Donald Trump. You'll be talking with people from Portland mm-hmm. now sending his private army into cities across the country. Just your comments on those two points before we have to wrap up.
One of the things that we're most concerned about, like you, is what 45 is doing. He is being very intentional about calling us terrorists when we are nothing but freedom fighters. We are human rights activists. We are constitutionally protected protesters. But we're recognizing that he is sending in federal law enforcement agencies to cities to quell protests and to cause fear and to threaten protesters so that they won't go out. It's an abuse of power. It's a violation of basic constitutional and democratic principles. And until our leaders in this country stand up to him and make sure that the White House is not permitted to do this, we're going to see more cities like Portland. We have federal agents in Portland snatching up protesters without due process of law. This is a clear, flagrant abuse of power. we have a separation of powers in our Constitution in large part because there's supposed to be a check between the different branches of government. His job is to only execute and enforce the law. He is the executive branch. There is no, he tried to invoke the Insurrection Act, but it did not work, and everyone rejected it resoundingly. And so this kind of federal it's militancy. It's a hard fact for us to recognize that we are looking at a White House that has chosen to act as our enemy. They have chosen to make us their straw man. They have chosen to target Antifa activists and make them appear as though they're somehow or another part of our movement. We do have connections. We definitely don't reject, but we are really clear that Black Lives Matter is about Black people's lives. It's about Black people's human rights. And we are concerned, of course, that 45 even came out recently and tried to blame us for the uptick in COVID-19 cases, blaming the protests. When in fact, the problem is that we have no federal leadership, we have no national policy regarding this illness, and we're looking at a pandemic straight in the face that he knew about long before he actually acted. And because he failed to act and refuses, or until recent days, refused to wear a mask, suggested that it was just like the flu and we could just use bleach or the sun to kill it. I mean, these are the kind of ridiculous remarks that really show a profound lack of leadership. And the fact that he would try to scapegoat activists, everyday grassroots moms and dads, daughters and sons who are out here trying to secure the human rights of our children, who we don't want to get shot in the back by a police officer's bullet anymore. We're trying to protect our children, our mothers and fathers, our grandmothers and grandfathers from the type of horrible, vicious violence that our communities have suffered at the hands of police for centuries. When we say defund the police and reimagine public safety, Margaret, very briefly, I just want to make sure that we understand that when we're talking about this, we're talking about putting money back into our communities for community-based programs that would help our kids, our elders, and adults across the board in our communities. That $150 million that the LA City Council approved in our people's budget is not about abolishing the police. It's about making sure that $150 million goes to the communities where they need it most.
Right. Well, on that note, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there. This is an ongoing conversation with our series campaigners for Black Lives, Dr. Rosalind Satchel. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us. Thank you, Margaret.
All right. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. I would now like to welcome Aaron Langell. It really is an honor to have Aaron here. We work closely with the Global Justice Ecology Project. He's the Strategic Communications Director for GJEP. He is a photojournalist. And both he and Ann Peterman, who's the executive director of GJEP, were in Chile in November and December of 2019. And Aaron, I'd like to welcome you because you're going to make a connection for us with what is happening on the streets in the United States and what is going on today in Chile, but also during the era of Pinochet. Welcome, Aaron.
Yeah, hi, Margaret. Good morning, and thanks for having me. I just want to mention, too, before this is over with, I'd like to just briefly tell how people could get to see a virtual online opening of a show we have concerning the photos and videos that we took down in Chile, and also see some of our work. But we can do that later.
Right. Well, you could tell us about that right now. I think we have posted that information also on the Sojourner Truth social media. But just quickly tell us about that, Aaron.
Okay, well, it's from our trip in November and December down in Chile, and we planned on having the exhibit on April the 3rd, but we closed it because of the epidemic, and I mean the pandemic, and still galleries really aren't open here, so in Buffalo, New York, so we're having this virtual opening. And if people are interested, they can go to BUENDIVIR gallery.org, and you can just click on the first thing you see, and it'll take you where you can register for the virtual opening. And also, you'll be able to see, we'll have by that time, we'll have all the photos online, the videos online. And thank you for letting me get that in, but it is definitely where art and politics meet, so we're happy to be doing this.
Right. And then, and just in terms of the connection with Chile and what is happening on the streets, on the ground, we'll be talking with a campaigner, an activist from Portland, Oregon, next. But when you were there, one of the things you spoke about was these, is it Carabineros?
Carabineros are the Chilean National Police.
Make those connections for us, Aaron.
Well, I think the connections were that you've been using extreme violence since October when the People's Uprising started. It started over a bus fare, but it actually is an all-out People's Uprising against neoliberalism and against the mistreatment of Mapuche and just about everybody that's being mistreated. And the Carabineros were shooting people in the face to blind them. Over 400 people were injured. Many thousands of people were detained. And they used excessive amount of tear gas, and it was very interesting place to be at that time, water cannons. And what I think that it just seemed to me that this is all, they're doing this because of the constitution that the dictator Pinochet left, I guess. And he's been gone since 1990. But the legacy still goes on, even though it's a supposed democracy there. And during the Pinochet regime, over 80,000 people disappeared by being snatched, being drug out of their homes, taken off the street. And when all of this started, actually when the Black Lives Matter became a month ago or so very much in the news, very fortunately, people were being shot in the eye. Somebody I don't think was almost blinded. And so that really got me to think, okay, they're using the same tactics against Black Lives Matter. And now what I find particularly scary is bringing in the federal Homeland Security and everything else and snatching people off the streets in Portland. And now troops or whatever they are, federal police are being sent into Chicago and also Albuquerque. I just heard a little while ago, and I guess it just is reminiscent of how a lot of things started to go in Chile with the dictatorship that the United States actually ushered in 1973, and they sent economists down to make the neoliberal model, and because of all that, there was extreme dictatorship, and neoliberalism is still going on in Chile, and there's a slogan down there that when the, I guess it's something like neoliberalism was born in Chile, it will now die in Chile. And that's how the commitment of the people that are in the streets and fighting in the streets, some of them, are just very, very, very adamant about what they want. And they want a whole different system than what is down there right now. And like
Aaron, if for a moment, just explain to our audience the reference to neoliberalism, how you understand it or what you mean, because not everyone, you know, uses that phrase.
Neoliberalism is basically the privatization of public services. That's the, I think a way that I can say it that probably will resonate more because that's what happened in Chile. And immediately public services were privatized, land was privatized, so the public sector lost out tremendously. The land that Pinochet gave away, the most egregious part of it, he gave away Mapuche territory, stole it, gave it to timber corporations that now have plantations all over Chile, and people are suffering from those effects with cancer and lack of water.
Right, and so just, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, we're moving if we're not already in a police state, because here you have, in Oregon, you've got these, you know, forces that very, very difficult to identify, and functioning as a kind of a paramilitary force. So you see, when you were in Chile, and I'm afraid we'll have to wrap it up after this final comment, when you were there, you and Anne went for one reason, which was exposing false solutions promoted, you know, at the UN climate conference. But when you were there, you also knew about and, in fact, visited Mapuche territory that were under attack. And not the same way, but similarly as communities, black communities and indigenous communities are under attack here in the United States. Final thoughts on this, Aaron Langell?
I don't know what to say as a final thought, except the Mapuche are reoccupying the land that was stolen from them. The one morning we were there, it was on Thanksgiving, United States speak, one of the protest camps, reoccupations. The carabineros came in, started with tear gas. They shot people. We have photographs of people that were shot, and we ended up staying with them for the whole day, just hoping that, you know, the police would not come back and start killing people. But what's happening down there, it seems like it's going on all over the world, sort of, but when it's coming to the United States now, I believe we've lived under fascism for a while, and most people don't want to admit that, but I think it's here, and I think that, to me, no matter who gets elected or selected for the next presidency, everybody has to be vigilant that we just don't turn everything into a police state.
To be continued. Aaron Langell, we so appreciate your work. Your photography is just incredible also. So again, on our website, we have information about how people can participate in that event. And we want to thank you for partnering with us for all of these years for our weekly Earth Minute, also our weekly Earth Watch. Aaron Langell, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Margaret. We've been doing this since 2009 in Copenhagen.
That's right. Okay. What we're going
Thanks,
to do
Margaret.
Now is we're going to take, thank you. We're going to take a short station break, and the rest of the hour we'll be discussing what's going on with Trump's army hitting the streets of Portland and threatening to hit the streets in cities across the United States. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
J'achète l'eau à Soumas, t'avais dans l'univers, jouant dans l'autre soleil, la j'ai pété en ville, t'avais caca pilil, je suis allé la poussière, je travaille pour bêcher.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Our handle on Instagram and Twitter at SoTrueRadio, our website www.sotrueradio.org, and we're nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. Today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Carlsbad, California, and internationally. We would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the Netherlands today. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, as protests following the murder of George Floyd have continued for close to 2 months in Portland, Oregon, the Trump administration has sent heavily armed and mass paramilitaries to roam the streets wearing generic camouflage without IDs or name tags. So what are the troops protecting? during the civil rights era, federal officers were deployed against people who were protesting, against the people who really to protect the protesters who were protesting racism and segregation at the time. This is a very, very different use now of these federal officers. On Wednesday, July 22nd, Oregon attorneys called for a restraining order against federal agents as protests continued in Portland. And apparently last night during the protest, the mayor of Portland was tear gassed by federal agents. And Wednesday night, protest followed a unanimous Portland City Council vote to end cooperation between the Portland Police Bureau and federal agencies. Let's go to a short clip from Reuters on the protest now.
Federal officers in the early hours of Tuesday fired tear gas to disperse protesters in an escalating series of standoffs between local demonstrators calling for police reform and unidentified camouflage-clad officers sent by Washington to quell the unrest. Local TV reported the demonstration assembled Monday night was the largest the city had seen in more than 50 nights of protest against police brutality and systematic racism. The crowd included hundreds of mothers and fathers dressed in yellow and orange, demanding the federal agents withdraw. Videos posted on social media showed some protesters banging on and pulling down fencing surrounding a federal courthouse before getting hit with a smoke canister. City and state leaders have called on President Donald Trump to pull back the secret police forces belonging to various agencies overseen by the Department of Homeland Security. But Trump on Monday said he would send law enforcement to more U.S. cities where protests have flared.
Well, I'm going to do something that I can tell you, because we're not going to let New York and Chicago and Philadelphia and Detroit and Baltimore and all of these, Oakland is a mess. We're not going to let this happen in our country, all run by liberal Democrats.
Despite the national outcry, Department of Homeland Security officials on Monday said they would not back down and would not apologize. The Chicago Tribune reported that DHS planned to deploy around 150 agents in that city this week.
What I'd like to do is I'd like to welcome Mike Crenshaw. He is based in Portland. He's an activist, an educator, and an MC. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Margaret.
So describe for us what's happening on the streets. What have you seen? What have you witnessed?
So, you know, this is day 55, I think, roughly 55 or 56 of various protests and marches and demonstrations around Portland. There's been consistent presence in the middle of downtown Portland at the Justice Center, which is a courthouse that also has a police station and a jail in it. And people have been gathered in the parks across the street from the Justice Center, usually about somewhere between 10:30 and 11:30 at night. The crowd has swells to a few hundred to a thousand people, and at some point, inevitably, the police, first the Portland Police Bureau, and now these federal agents are declaring a riot. And they're saying that the people are unlawfully gathered and they need to disperse. Once they declare that it's a riot, then they start firing CS gas, different forms of gas, and projectiles from pepper balls to rubber-coated steel bullets and other things. One of the other things that they've been doing is they've been kettling people in the protests. So initially, the protests would move throughout the downtown area, and at a certain point, the police would establish their kettling technique and block people in. That technique is pretty disturbing because the police will say on the loudspeaker to leave the area, but then people will be blocked in from four directions when they try to leave, and then they'll be gassed and hit with the sound the sound cannon, the different audio weapons that they have. In addition to the protests downtown, there have been protests in marches in other parts of the city. There's a police union hall that's a few miles from downtown in North Portland. That's been also been the site of recent protests. The building's been vandalized. Somebody broke into the building, set the building on fire. If you go by the building now, there's a lot of graffiti on it. And the question remains.
It sounds like a war zone. And Mike, Marjorie Cohn is going to be coming into this conversation, who is an attorney, to give us the legal aspects or illegal aspects of all of this. But describe, how is the how is it different, what's happening now with these federal officers? People don't even know what to call them, these paramilitary troops on the ground, as opposed to what was happening before with the Portland police. Mike Crenshaw.
I think the violence has escalated. And when I say violence, I'm not talking about the protesters. You know, there's a debate going on as to whether, you know, the graffiti and the vandalism is violent or not. These are acts of civil disobedience. I would consider it nonviolent direct action. Nobody's being harmed. No people are being harmed or injured by vandalism or you know, property damage. But usually what will happen during the protests is somebody will throw a bottle of water or somebody will set off a firework. A couple of nights ago, somebody had opened fire hydrants. So there are different things that happen that give the police or the federal troops an excuse to start attacking the protesters and declaring it a riot. There's also a lot of questions as to whether there are actual protesters who are protesting racism, police terror in the wake of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and other murders of black people. There's a debate as to whether the protesters are doing these things that set the police off, or whether there's provocateurs in the crowd.
Right, whether there are infiltrators. Hold that thought, Mike Crenshaw, because I'd like to bring Marjorie Cohn into this discussion, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, where she taught for several decades, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, a criminal defense attorney, legal scholar, political analyst, who writes books and articles. Her most recent book is Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Marjorie Cohn, welcome back.
Thanks, Margaret.
Now, listening to what Mike is describing, he has been out on the street in Portland. Tell us, what are your concerns from a legal and human rights perspective of what's going on there, and also the Trump's threat to spread that to other cities? They're going into Chicago, but William Barr is also making some distinction between the paramilitaries, as I would call them, in Portland and the officers, federal officers, that are being sent to Chicago and Albuquerque. Marjorie Cohn.
Yes, Margaret. Well, there are the federal secret paramilitary force that Trump is sending all over to boost his election prospects and act like a tough guy on a law and order platform, reminds me of Richard Nixon, violates at least four amendments to the Constitution, what these federal goons are doing in Portland and what they, hopefully not, but what they are likely to do in these other cities when Trump goes forward with his so-called surge. First of all, the First Amendment right to free speech and free press, the right to peacefully gather and express yourself, and the purpose of these federal troops. And they're not military, you notice, because the military has a duty, military service members have a duty to disobey unlawful orders, and Trump probably knows that they would not carry out these orders to brutalize the protesters in an illegal way. So he has sent more loyal troops from the Customs and Border Protection and Homeland Security, but the purpose of these federal troops is to discourage lawful protest. It's called an illegal prior restraint on the right to peacefully protest racial inequality in this situation. So that's the First Amendment violation. There's also a Fourth Amendment violation by seizing protesters without a warrant or a lawful exception to the warrant requirement. That is an illegal seizure. And also there's the use of excessive force, which violates the Fourth Amendment. Then there's the Fifth Amendment, right to due process. And when people are pulled off the street with no due process at all, thrown into a cell, the way that Mark Pettibone was, and not informed of the charges and not even told if they're under arrest, and then released without any paperwork and a secret proceeding, that violates the Fifth Amendment. Then we have the Tenth Amendment, which says that powers not delegated to the feds are restricted to the states. And yet Trump's troops are present over the objection of Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler, who, by the way, and I didn't hear the whole interview with your guest who's on now, but the mayor of Portland was tear-gassed last night. I don't know if he mentioned that. He was standing near a federal courthouse, and he was tear-gassed. And then the Oregon governor, Kate Brown, tweeted, I told Acting Department of Homeland Security Secretary Wolf that the federal government should remove all federal officers from our streets. His response showed me he's on a mission to provoke confrontation for political purposes. So at least violations of four constitutional rights, Margaret.
Yeah, and Mike Crenshaw, back to you here for a moment, because what impact do you think the presence of these troops have had? Because it seems as though it's had the opposite effect, because here you have these moms, the wall of moms now, and that is also now spreading to other cities with signs like "Fed, stay clear, moms are here," and signs like "I'm so disappointed in you." You have dads that are bringing in leaf blowers to try to somehow mitigate the tear gas. But I think the expectation was that there wouldn't be violence by these clandestine troops against the moms, but that did happen. So do you think that people are getting even more mobilized as a result of this? Just some final words from you, Mike Crenshaw.
Yeah, people are getting more mobilized. People's resolve is actually strengthening. You know, the escalation of violence coming from the state, from the police, from these unidentified armed troops, from Department of Homeland Security, is actually making more people realize how absurd this is. So I think it was 3 to 4 days ago, the march that happened, which had the wall of moms, was one of the biggest marches we've had since George Floyd was murdered. There had initially been a lull where the marches and the amount of people that were showing up were starting to thin out. And then when Chad Wolf, the chief of Homeland Security, came and declared that Portland was a war zone and that the so-called anarchists and the violent mob had to be put in place, then people came out even more and were more agitated by that. Another thing that's become clear is that this is a psychological operation. This is terror. This is meant to instill fear in people. When they're driving around in rented vehicles and unmarked vehicles and jumping out, there's usually at least four people in these vehicles with head-to-toe fatigues, with no identifying insignia, and with their faces covered with assault rifles. When they're jumping out and grabbing people unexpectedly, that's a terror operation. It's meant to frighten people, to terrorize people, and to traumatize people. No one knows until it came out that people had been placed under arrest and not released for at least 24 hours, there is a period where no one knows where those people went. No one knows where they were disappeared to. I think this is meant to scare people from speaking up, to scare people from demonstrating. And One more thing I wanted to say is, if you look at Portland demographically, Portland is one of the whitest cities in the United States. Okay, so in the wake of protest, rebellion, insurrection, uprising against the murder of black people at the hands of police, and then you juxtapose that against one of the whitest cities, when you look at the majority of the people who are in the streets right now, they're white. And so I think this is meant to instill fear in the white population that might be radical or might be on their way to becoming more radical, because they're the buffer zone between the elite and a mass revolutionary movement.
Right. And Mike, we hope that you will continue to brief us and share information with us about what's going on the ground. Marjorie Cohn, just some final thoughts from you.
Yes, well, the Oregon Department of Justice sued the Department of Homeland Security and the U.S. Marshals, and in their lawsuit they wrote, "Ordinarily a person exercising his right to walk through the streets of Portland who is confronted by anonymous men in military-type fatigues and ordered into an unmarked van can reasonably assume that he's being kidnapped and is the victim of a crime, and kidnapping by militia or other malfeasance dressed in a paramilitary gear would trigger the lawful right of self-defense." So that's it. And all, and because these ununiformed goons are running around Portland and driving around and snatching people, and presumably will do this in other cities, it won't take long, I'm afraid, Margaret, for right-wing vigilantes to do the same thing, and then all hell will break loose more than already. So what Trump has done is to really exacerbated the situation, and you know, there was peaceful protest going on, and I don't consider property damage to be violence. Your speaker was talking about that. But the real violence and the terror has been instilled by these federal goons that Trump is sending around the country, and it's who knows where it will end. But his sole goal is to appear like a tough guy so that he will be reelected, and he is targeting Democrat-controlled cities with Democratic mayors, so that he can call people terrorists, anarchists, and threaten that if Joe Biden is elected, that there would be more of the same. I don't think that the American people will be fooled. At least I hope not.
Yeah, and just very quickly, thank you, Marjorie Cohn and Mike Crenshaw. I'll tell you, one of the things I'm worried about, and I've heard other people worry about, is that Trump may be, in a way, creating his own sort of private army, even though that's not, you know, the official term. Because it's unclear whether he will acknowledge a loss in November if indeed he does lose. So this is to be continued. Very dangerous situation here. Marjorie Cohn and Mike Crenshaw, we'd like to thank both of you for joining us. Thank you. We're out of time, I'm afraid. Yes. Today's show produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our audio engineer, Kiana Williams, our assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for joining us, and stay safe, y'all. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation